Hi everybody, today we are for a really awesome treat. We have Alisa Bacon who joined us on the podcast, and Alisa is going to tell us all about herself. She is currently working on a contract with Microsoft Education, which she loves, judging by her comments, and we'll basically get to know her story, and she'll tell us more about Microsoft Education and her plans and her background. So, Alisa, thank you so much for joining. I'm super excited. Welcome.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
All right. So, why don't we start with a standard thing? Tell us all about yourself, everything that you want.
Yeah, sure. Just like you said, my name is Alisa Bacon. I'm 25 years old, and I live in Seattle currently, which is also where I grew up. I'm a UX designer at Microsoft on contract, and I work right now on the Microsoft Education team. I work on a couple of different products on the team. So I'm on OneNote Education, I'm on Microsoft Teams for Education, and then I also work on a product called Immersive Reader as well. I transitioned into UX about 2 years ago from a teaching background, and I'm 100% self-taught. I decided not to go like the boot camp route or go back to school for like a master's in design or anything. Everything I've learned so far has been sort of like just through myself. And I also have a bachelor's degree in math and philosophy, and then a master's degree in teaching. So as you can see, those are disciplines totally unrelated to UX, but somehow I'm here, working as a UX designer, and I totally love it.
Wow. That's very impressive. So, a couple of points. So you have undergraduate in math and philosophy. And then you have a master's in teaching, and you're just 25 years old.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. What an accomplishment. I think this is a really nuclear combination in terms of the career boost, because kind of like, imagine SpaceX launching the rockets into the space. I think that's basically what I heard, because, working in technology, math, philosophy is super critical. I think it's so underestimated and underrated for the technology space. And then obviously, education, and that's how you got into the Microsoft Education. I think it's a really, really great base. By the way, it kind of makes sense that you said you are self-taught. Because, if you have master's in education and teaching, so, you should be able to teach yourself too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Instead of just teaching others only. So this is great. So with the math and the philosophy background, why UX? Why, not something else? There are so many things you can do with such skills.
Yeah, that's a good question. So UX is really interesting, because I think it has a really similar balance in terms of like creativity and logical thinking, that you also find in math and philosophy. So with math and philosophy, you're constantly making different arguments, and it's really critical that your arguments are logically sound. But in order to really make like compelling and interesting arguments that are also logical, you also need a certain amount of creativity. And I think UX actually really scratches that itch for me, because every decision I make needs to have a really good reason behind it, right? So I'm like constantly making those arguments still. But I also still need that creativity to come in to come up with really compelling solutions as I'm creating designs. So I actually find that it translates really well. And then also like a lot of the skills that I picked up from teaching have been like great in terms of transferring to UX as well. Like a big thing that comes to mind is that design centers so much around empathy. And that is like a concept that I really learned to put at the center of my practice for teaching when I was in grad school. Because, you know, students are constantly transporting between different worlds. Like the world that they have at home is totally different and can even be at odds with the world that they have at school. And so they're moving between all these different contexts, and each student's life is so like infinite and rich. And in order to be a really great teacher, you need to understand that and like figure out how to work with them. And that's also so much what I do as a UX designer, is that each user is like an individual, right? We like call them users, which kind of takes away from their humanhood a little bit. But each user is like really an individual with a life, and they're in a specific context, and you have to like learn how to work with that. And any solution you build has to fit seamlessly into what they're already doing. So both of like all these different academic backgrounds that I have actually fit in really well into my UX practice.
I love it. Two points here. Empathy. This is great. I love what I heard. All our UX influencers, like, you know, Joe Natoli and Nick Fink, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with some of them or all of them.
Yeah.
That's what they preach, the empathy in UX, which we do not see enough, unfortunately, these days. Point number two. You mentioned, you know, you need to have a solid reason behind, you know, if something needs to be built. And I just wish that that was the case with all my business stakeholders, because normally they just, you know, push stuff down on you. You're trying to fight it if you don't see any rationale behind that.
Right.
But more often than not, you lose because, you know, they are the ones who are paying you. So and if you want to fight them, they'll probably find a way to replace you with somebody who does not fight or fight at all with them. So,
right.
By the way, speaking of math and philosophy, whenever I hear those two words in one sentence, I always think of Nassim Taleb. Are you familiar with this person?
I'm not, no. Who are they?
You're going to love it. So this is a guy who started as a trader, and he has books on math and logic and philosophy. And so one of my all-time favorite books that I've been tweeting about regularly is called Fooled by Randomness. I don't know if you heard that book name. But you will be blown away. I mean, I can totally, you know, see you just, you know, devouring this book sometime, you know, in the next few days. And then, so he just explains how most people who get successful in trading or other areas of life, they basically assume they are really great and they got the skills, while most of that is just randomness. And,
interesting.
Pure luck, right? And that's how people kind of get sucked into, you know, investing more and more because, you know, I keep winning. And then the black swan event comes in and everything crashes. You know, you're down 50% or your options are all, you know, gone and whatever that, you know, option trading. So margin trading. And then his recent book, Skin in the Game, is absolutely mind-blowing as well. So highly recommend his on Twitter at NN Taleb, so you can easily find them, find him and his books. But you're gonna love it. So
awesome! Yeah, I'll check him out.
All right. So that's enough of my rant about you know, Fooled by Randomness. So well, when you said you did the self-education, what exactly did you do?
So there's a lot of resources out there online, and so. In the beginning, I took a class on Skillshare, which is like a website that has, you know, videos where teachers post videos and you take courses. So I took a class by a woman named Carly Cuniff on UX, and it helped really lay out the foundation and helped solidify my interest in UX. But that was really the only class or even like online resource that I really thought was productive in learning. I focused mainly on books and mentorship to help guide my learning. you know, I looked at a whole ton of resources online, but it's really difficult, especially as a beginner, to figure out what is actually like a really valuable resource versus what is just like, you know, a Medium article that's written by another junior designer who's just trying to fill up their Medium portfolio. So books I highly recommend. I can give a few recommendations. The whole O'Reilly series is really great. They do like information architecture, great book. Understanding Context, also another great book. Obviously, the ones that always get brought up are like Don't Make Me Think and Design of Everyday Things. I think those are also really great to read at the very beginning of your practice. But as you start to dig deeper and deeper into UX and sort of learning, I definitely recommend the O'Reilly books. Another book that I recommend is About Face, The Essentials of Interaction Design. And that's a pretty thick one, but it's almost like a textbook. And it definitely reads like a textbook, but it's very practical in that it gives a lot of examples and just, you know, ties a lot of the points together so that it's easy to not only understand, but also directly apply. So books have definitely been like a foundational learning source for me. But what really takes my learning to the next level is definitely a mentorship. What I have found with design is that it's really difficult to know what you don't know. I think like a few months into me scavenging the internet and looking for resources, I was like, yeah, like I've got the hang of UX. Like I kind of get what it is. You know, you have a process and you do this, you like do research and then create personas. But when you're actually working on a real product, it's really not that clean of a process. And it's also really difficult to see where you have big gaps in your process. And so having a mentor to constantly give you feedback and tell you, you know, when you should use a different method or ask you why you used a specific thing, that's what really helps you move forward as a designer, I think. So books and mentorship are definitely my two big resources that I leaned on for self-teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if that's okay, maybe you can send me the links to those books. I can put them in the episode notes. That will be very valuable for people.
Yeah.
And so how long have you been at Microsoft at this point?
So I've been there since August, so about 6 months now.
Okay. And you mentioned that you are moving into kind of like you're looking at a full-time position sometime in the future.
Yeah. So I'm on contract there right now. And definitely my next step is to try to move into a full-time position. Hopefully at Microsoft, I think that would definitely be my dream. I have really enjoyed working here so far. But I would eventually start looking at other companies too. But in terms of like my next steps for my next position, definitely looking for full-time.
Okay. Would you have any comments? You know, a lot of people obviously are working on contract. A lot of people are doing full time. Do you have any point of view on, you know, the trade-offs and the benefits of either one?
Yeah.
From your experience? Or maybe you have other people who work with you at Microsoft who are, you know, pure contract and they don't want to go to full time. And some people are full time. They would never go to contract. So maybe, you know, that kind of experience?
Yeah. I know that before I started contracting at Microsoft, I was apprehensive to start a contract position. There's a little bit less stability. Generally, you're paid hourly, and, you know, that just is not as stable as like a salaried position. You don't get all the benefits that mm-hmm. all your other coworkers that you work with have. So there are definitely a lot of drawbacks. And so I was apprehensive about starting as a contractor, but since I started, I'm actually very glad that I went the contracting route. The main reason being that, especially at a larger company and being a more junior designer, it can be really intimidating. And so going in on contract is nice almost because there's like an end date in sight. So you know that like if you totally hate it or if it's just not an environment that you really thrive in, then there's like an expiration date. And from that point, you can go on to find a different role. And so having that built in almost was, it was like a nice safety net because it meant that you didn't have to worry about being permanent on your team. And then the other thing is that it's a lot easier to get your foot in the door at these larger tech companies as a contractor. Yeah. And the amount that I have learned working at Microsoft has just been insane. I've definitely learned way more here in, honestly, even like in the first month that I was here than like the whole year leading up to it. And so contracting like gives an opportunity for people who may not have the experience yet to be able to land a full-time position. It's, I almost think of it like a paid internship almost. It's just a really great way to gain experience and get a feel for what it's like to work at a larger company without the pressure of having to go through like 2-day long interviews and, you know, worry about whether or not you're a good fit for the team. It's like a really great trial run. So I've really enjoyed working as a contractor.
That's a really great point. And I remember that there was one time in my life where I was hired by a major healthcare company here in Minneapolis, which I thought I would never, you know, get a chance to be hired. The hiring manager basically spent, you know, 30 minutes with me on the phone. And like 15 minutes after that, my recruiting agency told me that I got the job. So it's she never even met me in person. She just kind of liked what she heard on the phone. And I was really surprised. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, when is the in-person interview? And she's like, no, I mean, she just hired you. I'm like, well, that's cool. So, yeah, wow. So I just showed up to my first day. And that's when we met for the first time. So. And everything actually worked out really great. I spent a year there. They extended my contract several times because they went by like 3 months or something. And then I actually had a full-time offer, but I moved to a different company. But yeah, we had a great chemistry with that woman, and maybe that chemistry kind of helped connect on the phone. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe she didn't have time to meet with me in person, so she just said, "Ah, screw it, you know. But let's just do it."
Right. Yeah. Awesome. I mean, part of getting like a full-time design role is that there's so much that has to go into it. Like, you know, there's usually like a portfolio presentation. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure your portfolio is like beautiful. There's like hours and hours of behavioral questions. And so it's nice because with contracting roles, the interview stakes are definitely a lot lower. You generally don't have to do like a full presentation. You do have to interview, of course. But like I said, the stakes are lower. So, it's definitely a nice way to sort of be able to get into a job and start getting experience without having all those barriers in place, because there's so many different places in the interview process that can go wrong, especially if you don't have the experience or don't have access to like really valuable feedback to be able to iterate on your performance. So yeah, definitely contracting is great for when you're starting out.
Yeah, it is much easier to get in, and then when you are, let's say you are offered the full-time role based on your performance, I don't think you will need to jump through all those hoops because, you know, they already know you, you worked, you proved, so it's probably more of a just a technical conversion of the role versus kind of spinning up the entire standard full-time job hiring process. So
yeah, definitely.
So yeah, it's a totally, totally great way. Speaking of your mentors, you know, we discussed mentorship and how it's important for younger folks to get going. And you said you were, you know, in a good position to have a mentor or, you know, multiple mentors. Can you give us, you know, one or two examples where mentors really helped you in some specific way or clarified a very specific aspect of career growth or career planning? Because obviously, you know, you interact with them either as needed or, you know, on some kind of a regular basis. But do you have an example where you kind of struggle to plan your next move or struggle to understand something about the industry, and then you kind of talked with them and then they clarified it for you and it kind of gave you that necessary piece of the information to move forward?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of what I've used or what I've spoken with mentors about is my portfolio and how I can make it more competitive. I've had so many mentors just like totally tear apart my portfolio. And it's really valuable to have someone with more experience than you go through and just point out all the holes that exist, because like I said, it's so difficult to look at your own piece of work and, identify what's missing from it. So portfolio has been the biggest one. One of the mentors, who took me through my most recent portfolio transformation, was someone that I got linked up with through a formal mentorship program. So I linked up with her through Hexagon UX, which is a women's and gender nonconforming folks UX support group, essentially. And they have chapters all over the United States, and I want to say all over the world. So if you live in a fairly large city and you are a junior designer, definitely see if Hexagon UX, and obviously identify as a woman or gender fluid or gender queer, then I would definitely recommend you check out Hexagon UX and see if it's in your area. Because having like a formal mentor mentee relationship can also be really helpful, because it is difficult to just, you know, cold contact someone on LinkedIn try to build that relationship. And then the other nice thing that came out of my mentor through Hexagon UX is that she linked me up with one of her old mentees, who also started as a contractor at Microsoft and then turned full-time. And so she has been my most recent mentor, because she's sort of helping me get started with the process of, you know, having conversations with my managers about my desire to be full-time, and sort of getting their support in helping me advocate for myself on both on the team as well as for other teams at Microsoft. So definitely finding someone who's been in the same position as you has been incredibly helpful. Like if you can find anyone who comes from the same, you know, academic background or same like previous career path who then turned to UX, that will definitely be the most valuable.
Yeah, that aspect actually of the mentorship, that I mean, obviously they can share a lot of valuable knowledge and information with you. But what you just mentioned, that example that I also value extremely highly, is the networking, because these people, they first of all, in order for them to be your mentor, they have to, you know, at least like you, right? Nobody wants to mentor the person they don't like or don't, you know, respect or something.
Definitely.
So that has to be there by definition. And once they start working with you, they learn more about you. They learn, they connect with you on the personal level. The chemistry needs to be there. And once that relationship is formed and is going deeper, they will do all they can to help you out, connect with other, you know, valuable people. Like, you know, you just gave a great example of that. So it's not only helping you, you know, guiding your career, but also that very valuable networking, because they will know so much about you. And when they tell their network about you, they will not just say, oh, you know, this girl is, you know, pretty smart, but they will actually tell how they connected with you, how you think, because they actually learn how you think, right? You tell them about a problem, you discuss the problem with them, they understand your level of thinking. So they can position you in a much, you know, better way in front of their network rather than if they were just a standard network connection. So I cannot, you know, stress highly enough the importance of mentorship. Like, you know, don't even, once you are out of college or you're trying to switch careers, drop everything else, invest every single minute of your time in finding, you know, one or two or more mentors, and go deep into those relationships, because they will be very critical. That's what I think.
Yeah, definitely. So. The nice thing also about having a mentor, what you hinted at, is that really once you connect with a mentor, you also get access to their entire network as well. And so you've essentially just doubled your network simply by connecting with another human. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think finding a mentor is important, not only for your personal growth as a designer, but also like years down the line, you might find that someone who is in your mentor's network is in a position for something that could really help you out, whether that's your next, you know, job or whatever it is. Yeah, definitely really important to maintain those relationships.
Yeah. So let's switch back to Microsoft. Tell us a little bit about what products have you worked on? Are you working on like apps or web-based Node product that is used by students in schools?
So most of my work so far has been on OneNote Education. And so we're basically a vertical off of the standard OneNote product. For those of you who aren't familiar with OneNote, OneNote is essentially like a digital binder. It's like a note-taking tool, and it has organization built in, so you can, you know, organize your life and like your school and have different tabs for each different subject that you're taking notes on. And so I work
like
on
a tab for mentors.
Yeah, exactly. So I work on the version of that that's used in classrooms. We call it Class Notebook, but essentially it gives teachers a digital space so that each student in the class has their own notebook, and the teacher sort of manages each student's notebook and is able to pass out papers, grade work, sort of like give out content basically for their class and organize it in a way that makes sense for their class. And so most of the work that I've been doing has been on the teacher side of like the interactions behind how the teacher can go about passing out papers to the students electronically, you know, what happens if they want to delete those papers, etc. And then in addition to that, I've been working quite a bit on Teams for Education. So Microsoft Teams by itself is like a collaboration platform with things like chat and collaborative file sharing built in. It's kind of like Slack, if you're familiar with Slack. Mm-hmm. And so we also have an education vertical for that product, where a similar sort of idea, each team is basically a classroom and teachers can hand out work to students. Students can have discussions and work on group projects all within Teams, share files, etc. And so I've been spending some time on that as well.
Nice. Yeah, it actually makes sense. So basically that OneNote for schools is basically like a software as a service, right, to manage all the workflows with papers and grading and looking at the papers and sending papers from, you know, one person to another. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like Google Docs in one package, right?
Right. It's like Google Docs with like an extra layer of organization, mm-hmm. and then different sort of like permissioning and file sharing for specific sets of users like students or other staff members, etc.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything really cool that you learned about this particular process? Like, you know, let's say you come in and you start designing the logic or the workflow, and you think that, you know, it probably makes sense to do it this way, but then somebody told you a different viewpoint, or you did a UX research and you found something different. Do you have any examples of those kind of interesting learnings?
Yeah, definitely. Like I've said, I've learned so much being at Microsoft so far. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work that I do is very heavy in interaction design. And our the tasks that our teachers are trying to accomplish and the ways that they have to accomplish those tasks are fairly complex. And as a result, the interactions themselves get very complex as well. And so a big thing I've learned is that it's extremely critical to be able to learn or to be able to lean on the interaction patterns that already exist within the OneNote ecosystem, as well as other Office products. And so mm-hmm. I remember coming in and having a design project that was fairly simple looking back on it, but I was totally lost because I was like, oh my gosh, I just have no idea how to design this. Like, what kind of interactions do I use? What sort of UI do I use? And I remember pulling in another designer on another team and asking her to help me walk through it. And she was like, all right, you know what? We're going to dig into OneNote. We're going to dig into Outlook. We're going to dig into Word and see if we can find anything analogous in there. And we found so many patterns in there that would translate really nicely to the problem that I was trying to solve. And so a big thing that I learned, especially working at a larger company like Microsoft, is that for a lot of the interactions, it's very likely that someone has already solved that problem. And so you should always start by searching around for the interaction to see if it's already out there, see how they're using it, and see if you can translate that to your situation. And that honestly blew my mind because ever since then, I've been very careful about looking out for interaction patterns. And mm-hmm. it just helps a lot, especially in terms of keeping consistent with the rest of the Microsoft Office suite. But yeah, that's definitely a big thing.
Awesome. I would love to work on something like that. It sounds really, really fascinating. Just a very curious question. Let's say you're at your desk and Satya Nadella comes over and says, Alisa, you can pick any Microsoft product that you want to work on, and I'll give it to you. What product would you pick?
Oh, that's a great question. I really love working on the products that I'm working on now, especially Teams for EDU. And a big part of that is because of the user base we're building for. We are creating products for teachers and students. That means that I get to interact with teachers and students on almost a weekly basis. And those are just groups of people that I love talking to. Like, first of all, students are adorable. Mm-hmm. I was doing some user testing with fourth graders a couple weeks ago, and it is just like, it's just so fun to spend time with them. And not only that, it's interesting because we're working on products where quality really matters. Mm-hmm. It's not just about getting money. Like, it's not like an e-commerce product where we're just trying to get the users to spend their money. It's like really at the root of it, how can we make education work better through technology, and how can we improve teachers' lives? How can we save them time? How can we help students exceed and excel in school? So I really love being able to work at sort of like a higher level and not just be like trying to increase numbers all the time, but really striving for like quality. I love that.
Man, I'm totally jealous, very, very jealous. The way you are describing it, I can totally see myself doing that. And Actually, you are one of the luckier UX designers because, you know, based on what I hear on Twitter and based on my personal experience, we almost never get to interact with the real users. For whatever reasons, you know, corporate doesn't want to bother customers, or, you know, some focus groups are just lame and not very real. So you're actually in a really great position to be able to talk to the very end users. And in your case, you know, the fourth graders, I'm pretty sure, yeah, it's just like you said, it's probably very, very adorable.
Yeah, it also definitely helps that our user group is pretty well defined. And, you know, even a group like teachers, they are also fairly active on Twitter. And so being able to, like, identify your group and access and gaining access to them, those are definitely a lot more difficult with various different products. So we're definitely lucky in the sense that it's fairly well defined for us.
One question that I have is kind of a long-term strategic question. I'm very fascinated by the education industry, and I'm very interested to see where it's going, because obviously, you know, many people say that the system is broken, and you know, there are pretty solid reasons behind those statements. When you guys do your UX research, and, you know, I don't know how far out you have a roadmap for, you know, OneNote education, but what trends are you guys exploring? Like, right now, the current state of your product, like you described some of the workflows, you know, there are papers, the teachers grade them and, you know, pass them around and, you know, whatever else they do with them. Mm-hmm. Do you see any trends, or are you at least exploring, or maybe you are creating those trends? Because, you know, obviously the most disruptive technology products were created not based on user research, but by offering users a better way to do things without users even knowing, you know, that this mm-hmm. is a better way. So do you guys see any mechanical, technical, logistical kind of trends that would either change or slightly at least modify the way that, you know, students write papers? Maybe there will be no papers. Maybe there will be some kind of a different documentation format. Maybe teachers will have to work with different types of documents and analyze them in some way, and maybe you guys will provide some certain tools for the teachers to analyze those, you know, maybe numbers or something, some analytical tools, so the teachers can actually, like, you know, AI, right? Instead of the teacher investing all this time to really read through and understand every single word or every single number that the student put down, maybe there will be some AI help saying, you know, the high level assessment of this paper or this Excel spreadsheet is, you know, here are all the misses, here are potential cells you want to look into because there are some formula inconsistencies. So, you know, whatever crazy idea you can come up with in terms of the future of that particular product and how it manages the current process that may change in the future. I would love to hear if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. So we have a team here at Microsoft called Hacking STEM, and they do a lot of lesson development that incorporates technology into very, like, hands-on tactile activities. So they do really amazing things like building robotic fingers that you can put at the tips of your own fingers and sort of, like, measuring you know, the speed and velocity and things like that, and inputting that directly into, like, Excel spreadsheets and being able to, like, read trends. And so the Hacking STEM team does a lot of amazing work, and there's a ton of curriculum out there for any teachers who are interested in looking into it further. So there is sort of that, like, exploratory, we do have that branch of, like, exploratory curriculum development that like integrates technology in a more interesting way than just saying, hey, like write your essay on a laptop this time. So they're doing really amazing work. I would say another sort of area that I hope we start focusing on more is being able to build products for schools and regions and students that don't have a lot of access to stable internet connections and mm-hmm. have more like barriers to, you know, doing things like purchasing laptops or iPads. I think that like offline experience for education is something that can definitely be explored a lot more. A lot of the work that we do sort of assumes that the classroom has laptops. Maybe the students have their own devices, but there's a lot of underserved communities as well who don't have like that stable internet connection at home or don't have access to a computer at home. And so from a larger picture perspective, I would love to start thinking about like, how can we also help those students incorporate technology into their lives without them having to rely on like a stable internet connection. So that's definitely like a big topic that's on my mind and on my team's mind as well.
Yeah, so one thing that popped in my head when you said no stable internet connection, I think you guys can leverage, and I don't know, maybe you're already doing something like that, or maybe this idea is very silly, but this thing just popped in my head that if there is a classroom in some remote area or, you know, just, you know, no internet connection or very unstable, so you cannot really sync, you know, in the same classroom, you cannot sync students' computers with the teacher's computer, as long as you have laptops with Bluetooth, maybe, you know, OneNote can leverage Bluetooth to just, you know, connect with each other. And obviously, there will be a lot of Bluetooth radiation inside a classroom this way, because, you know, this is still kind of a controversial topic. Yeah, you know, or maybe like, you know, one time syncing like every few minutes. But yeah, I mean, those close range connections inside the classroom can just totally connect and you'll be basically online. You'll be offline in terms of the entire internet. But all the students and teachers will be connected through this, you know, close range technology like Bluetooth or something like that. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Like, I would love to be able to speak with more teachers who have experience with, you know, unstable internet connections to be able to start thinking about these kinds of solutions. But again, it sort of comes down to access because those kinds of teachers who work in those environments are just geographically much farther away than us here in Seattle. So like I would love to get to a point where we expand our sort of like teacher discourse beyond the Seattle area and beyond Twitter and really reaching out to teachers who work in more technologically sort of like isolated parts of the world as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super fascinating. So let's as we kind of get closer, let's ask this question. So in 5 years, what would be your ideal job? What how do you see yourself going to be, like a, you know, UX manager or UX director, or you see yourself more like, you know, you said you like the OneNote product that you're working on, so you know, 5 years from now or 3 years from now, because, you know, 5 years in this day and age seems like a really long time, so let's say, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, do you see yourself managing a team of UX designers around OneNote education, or you would like to see yourself more as a, you know, product manager driving the vision and the roadmap for the product?
I definitely would like to stay in the design route. I potentially see myself managing eventually. I already love supporting people who are junior to me, and that's like a big reason that I went into teaching in the first place. But one of my closest friends at work recently shared some advice with me to really protect my time as an individual contributor, or IC, which is basically just a word for people who are not management level.
Right.
So in order to be a really good manager one day, she said it's really important to take time to hone and master your craft. And you can really only have the bandwidth to do that as an IC. So I think in 5 years, I hope I'm still in the weeds with lots of hands-on projects as an IC. But with sort of like, I would love to be an IC at a company or on a team where I see myself sort of progressing directly to that like manager role. So I guess I like hope I'm still an IC, but like definitely on track to becoming a manager like in the foreseeable future.
Okay. So between design and product, let's say 10 years from now, or, you know, between 10 and 15, whatever it takes, depending on the career track and the timing, would you see yourself more of a VP of digital design or VP of product?
Probably design, because one of my big bucket list items is to eventually get a PhD in human-computer interaction. I am sort of like an academic at heart. I love sort of like the philosophies behind design. I love like the history that went into it, and like the more academic side of it. And so I would love to go and study that. And I think that would better suit me for a VP of design route. Although I definitely also worry about being too sort of up in the clouds with design and not having enough concrete vision to like move things forward. But that's, you know, I don't necessarily have to be like a VP or anything. I'll sort of figure out how I can fit myself into a role with that sort of academic background.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you stay in the corporate career track, you'll eventually hit that VP level. Otherwise, you know, you'll stop growing in terms of the career. So that's kind of an interesting North Star vision to have, because, you know, well, once you have that, I spoke about this either with Tom or Libby on my previous podcast. I struggled quite a bit throughout my career, like, you know, what I want to do, because I thought I was good at many different things. And then I figured that that's kind of a problem. You need to be, you know, really good at a couple of things versus, you know, kind of good at many things. Mm-hmm. So I, when I narrowed it down to product, I kind of started thinking, okay, so in terms of like 10 years from now, what do I want to be, like, you know, chief operating officer? I mean, assuming the opportunity is there, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, something else, but somehow VP of product, for example, for me makes sense. And that actually helps me stay on track, because it kind of lights my way, right? Like, once I step out of the light spot, I know that I'm off. So it's kind of a good, you know, framework to employ as you explore your further career options and things like that. So something to guide you by.
Definitely. I think another thing is that, like, there's still some debate in the design community about whether you like eventually hit a ceiling with IC, and then whether management is really your next step after that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, some designers are really just great at designing, and by becoming a manager, they move farther away from that. And what if they're not great at managing? You know, so I think there's definitely like open questions. Maybe we'll see some shifts in the next few years about what it means to grow as like an IC, and maybe we'll start to see a shift away from going into management and like carving out a new sort of like, I don't know, Uber IC path or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually, this is like a real time thought. I've never thought about it this way, but yeah, I mean, I do agree that eventually you'll probably hit some kind of a ceiling because, you know, you can only add so much value by, you know, delivering Figma or Sketch or Zeppelin designs. But at the same time, if you think of the word design more globally and holistically, there's so much more to design than just, you know, Zeppelins and UI of the software. There is hardware design, right? And you are at a great place with Microsoft where you guys, you know, have Surface and all kinds of other devices that you can actually jump onto or expand your career to. And by having the deep knowledge of software design, like OneNote, right? You can maybe then work with the hardware team to better design Surface products for education, for example, right? Like putting together seamlessly hardware and software, because this is a absolutely different level of design understanding. And obviously, your position level within the company will be growing higher. You can still be called software and hardware designer, but you know, your seniority level will be like a director, right? Or a senior director. You don't have to be called a director, but you will be at that level with the pay and with the perks and with the authority. And another one is the voice design, right? Like, you know, Alexa, tell me this, tell me that. Like, it's non-visual. You do not interact with anything. It's not hardware. It's not software. You're not looking at anything. So it's a completely different understanding of the user research, and kind of like, you know, slowly calibrating those options that the voice will give back to you, what results it will pull, what information it will tell you, how it will tell you, what supplementary questions it will ask you, like, you know, hey, Alexa, tell me this. And Alexa kind of spits out the question. And then, like, should we also ask the user, like, you know, would you like me to do something about this, right? So, and then, you know, put all this together, the software, the hardware, and the voice design. And now you are, you know, one of maybe 100 people on Earth who can actually do such a global, comprehensive three platform design. And you know, there's not a lot of people like you in the entire world. So you know, don't just limit your design understanding to, you know, here's OneNote, here's the screen, here are the buttons and flows. There's hardware, there's voice, and who knows what else. And obviously AI will play into this quite a bit because, you know, you need to design software logic with AI in pretty soon, right? So I'm pretty sure AI will come to education and OneNote. So that'll be really interesting too. So, you know, you got a lot, and especially with your math and philosophy background, you know, this is math will relate to machine learning very well because, you know, that's where all the numbers and the mathematical models come in. So, yeah, I mean, I'm really excited for you, for your career. It looks like, you know, you're on a great track, and you know, in 5 years you'll kind of I'm sure you'll be super successful in 5 years based on what I heard from you today.
Thank
So
you.
yeah.
Hope so. Gotta keep working.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So let's wrap up, and will you have any final words, any advice, or you know, words of wisdom for people like you who are just out of college, what to do and how to do it?
Yeah, I would say, especially for folks who are coming from a different career path, try to really leverage the existing skills that you have. Like, for example, Microsoft EDU wanted to hire me specifically because I had a master's in teaching. And up until that point, it was kind of difficult to get interactions with other companies because I think they didn't see my background as valuable. So figure out what teams are going to really want your background and really leverage that to your advantage.
Sounds good. Short and sweet.
Yeah.
Okay, Lisa, absolutely awesome conversation. I'm sure people will absolutely love it. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about OneNote, about our school education, a little bit more about Microsoft. This is great. Thank you so much for attending.
All right. Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
All right. And thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you also have a blast listening to this episode, and we'll see you soon.
All right. Bye.